This session is called Coping with Downsizings. My name is Annalisa Archer. I'm the Director of Human Resources Services at the National Archives, and I'm going to be moderating our panel this morning and wanted to start off by introducing the panelists that we have here. To my left, and speaking first for us today, is Elizabeth Atkins, who is the Director of Global Records and Information Management at CSC. She was previously with Ford Motor Company for 12 years, where she led the company's global information management program. And she also spent 11 years at Kraft Foods, where she was manager of archive services. She is a certified archivist, certified records manager, and a fellow of the Society of American Archivists. She served as treasurer and president of SAA and as president of the Academy of Certified Archivists. And she and Phil Mooney have co-taught SAA's Business Archives Workshop for nearly 20 years. So many of you may already be familiar with Elizabeth if you've spent any time at all in the SAA community. Jill Tatum has a BA and MA in history from the University of Dayton, MSLS with a concentration in archives administration from Case Western Reserve University, where she is currently serving as the university archivist. She has over 30 years' experience in academic and corporate libraries and has been an academic archivist since 1983. And rounding out our panel to my far left is Conley Edwards, who has served as a member of the staff of the Library of Virginia since August of 1974. He served as a reference archivist, senior records management analyst, head of the public services and programs section of the archives, acting state archivist, and, as if that wasn't enough, from January 1996 until November 2009, served as the State Archivist of Virginia and director of both the Archival and Information Services Division and the Archival and Records Management Services Division within the Library of Virginia. He retired in November 2009 after 35 years of state service, and we're very pleased he could join us today. We have, I hope, what is going to be an engaging panel for you, talking about a sensitive topic with respect to downsizings, and unfortunately one that we think we may be hearing more and more about in the years to come. Each of our panelists is going to represent a different perspective from downsizings. We're going to talk from the perspective of the downsized employee. We're going to also talk a little bit from the perspective of being a survivor of downsizings, being someone who's left behind in a downsized organization. And then Conley's going to talk to us from the corporate perspective or organizational perspective, taking a look at downsizings through that lens. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth. Each of the panelists is going to go through their presentations, and then at the end, we'd like to invite some discussion and have a little Q&A with you. So thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Annalisa. Is this on? Okay. Normally, I would stand. I apologize to the folks over to the my right side of the room, but I had surgery 2 weeks ago to correct a bone spur in my left foot, so I am not spending a lot of time on my feet. So bear with me. Okay. So my story at Ford Motor Company is that my job there was eliminated on January 21st of last year after 12 years with the company. On the one hand, the loss of my job came as a surprise in the light of the fact that I had had 12 years of promotions and very positive reviews. On the other hand, it was no surprise at all in light of the state of the economy and the fact that Ford Motor Company had been struggling to make a profit for several years. I was lucky. I received some career transition from a company called Wright Management, which specializes in helping people work through issues such as after having been downsized. And the reason I wanted to share this with you today, Ford Motor Company paid for Wright Management to help me out. I got the benefit of a lot of very sound advice, some interesting insights into how to look for a new job that I wouldn't have known otherwise, and I thought it would be a nice thing to share that with others. I did land a new job at CSC on July 13th last year. CSC, by the way, I like to call it the biggest company you've never heard of. It's a company with 95,000 employees located in more than 50 countries, and it is a company that specializes in IT services and consulting. So Let's talk first about the process of going through the grief process after losing one's job. It's very similar to losing a loved one. And this is shown sort of as a straight line going, starting with shock and denial and reaching acceptance. It's often not quite so clear a straight line as you go through these stages of emotion. But at some point or another, you're most probably going to experience, if you've lost your job, one or more of these emotions. And it's important to be able to get through those emotions. I think in particular the shock you feel when you get the news that your job's been eliminated is something that you need some time to be able to get over. You need someone you can trust, you can talk to, talk through all those emotions. But you also need to recognize that the sooner you get to the acceptance end of the emotions, the sooner you'll be getting a new job. So it's important to work through, but it's also important to try to get to the point where you can move on. So one of the first things that you have to do when you've lost your job is to deal with the questions you're going to get. I had a lot of people who were like just shocked to find out that my job had been eliminated at Ford, and you have to have an answer ready for them. So you want to put together a response that's short, truthful, and as positive as possible so that you're prepared to answer this question, which will come to you over and over again, including in job applications and in job interviews. So you want to avoid statements that might be on the bitter and unhappy side and try to work with one that is actually more positive. And I, when the first slide of this presentation, I gave you my reason for leaving statement. That's what happened at Ford. Short and easy. Once it's over, you can move on to the next topic of discussion. The other thing that you have to do is you have to assess yourself. You have to figure out, you have to do a self-assessment as to where you are in your career, what your strengths are, where you want to go as you're in your professional development, your personal style, whether you're looking for rapid advancement or perhaps stability that's more important to you, whether you want to relocate, whether you like to travel, all of these things that go into deciding what's the right type of position for you to be able to move on to. Then you want to think about where you want to work. Would you like to be self-employed or an employee of an organization? A lot of people, after they've lost their jobs, do go on to do consulting and find it to be a very rewarding experience. What kind of setting you want to work in, whether it's a large or small one, whether it's well established, or perhaps you're joining an organization that's just getting started and there's lots of opportunity for advancement. You have to consider all of the things that are covered in this slide and come up with an honest answer, and then identify what is for you your ideal employer. And that's part of putting your marketing plan together for getting yourself a new job. You then have to establish an effective resume. And here's the thing that you have to realize. Most resumes only get reviewed for an average of 30 seconds. So you have a very short time to make an impression. One of the things you want to do is limit the length. If you've had fewer than 10 years experience, keep it to one page. If you've got more than 10 years experience, keep it to two pages. Now, I'm not sure how this formula works within the context of an academic community where I know curriculum vitaes with very long, extensive outlines of experience tend to be more common. But I do know that in the corporate and I suspect government job market, keeping it short to the point is very, very important. And I would add, too, that you can probably consider adding an appendix to your resume if it's important to list publications and presentations and other professional activities. So the other thing you need to work on is a summary leading paragraph that concisely describes who you are and what you bring to the table in terms of a new employer. And this was, I've got some slides at the back of the presentation that go into more detail about how to structure a resume and how to create this leading paragraph. I worked for like a month on that stupid leading paragraph. And it was really important that it may be the only thing that is read in your resume. So it's really important to get it done well. The other thing to keep in mind is that more and more people are using technology to review resumes. Whether you've posted your resume on an online database for job seekers or whether you've submitted it through an automated system to an employer, they're using crawlers to go out and look for key phrases to see if they can find and winnow down from the candidates that they're looking for. So look in job ads that seem like the kind of job you want and look for phrases that are repeated and make sure that those show up in your resume. You want to use format, a lot of white space, bold type and indentations and bullets to help make it a more attractive format and one that will guide the reader's eye. And there's a number of things that often show up on resumes that you don't want to include, including things like your personal information or characteristics or hobbies or interests, unless that's somehow relevant to the career job. And then the other thing you can do is share it with others. Ask for their critique. This does a couple of things. Number one, it will improve the quality of your resume. And number two, you're starting to network. By sharing it with people that you know and you trust, you're going to tell them your story, you're going to get the word out, you're looking for a job, and they will be keeping you in mind because they'll have just seen all of the qualities that you bring to the job market. So another thing that was kind of interesting to realize is that I have always thought when I was looking for a new job to go and look at ads that have been posted. And that actually only represents a very small fraction of the job market. There's about a third of the job market that is called the reactive job market or the formal job market. These are positions that have been publicized in some way, and the selection process is very competitive. About two-thirds of the job market is hidden from view. It's not yet publicized, and there's significantly less competition. So this might include either an impending vacancy or a vacancy that has just taken place or a job that's just been added or being modified. And these are the jobs that actually Wright Management was encouraging me to try to go after, and they've got some strategies in terms of how to deal with that. So there's strategies for both the reactive job market and the proactive job market. And in the reactive job search, you want to respond to ads between 4 to 14 days after they've appeared because there's a better chance within that time frame you'll actually be noticed. You want to be brief, as we talked about before. You want to focus on what the employer needs and tweak your resume and tweak your cover letter to address those employers' needs. And you do want a cover letter. More and more I've noticed, being someone who's also interviewed people for jobs, people just send their resume in. But a cover letter is important because you can specifically address both the defined and implied qualifications in the ad. And here's an important thing. Don't send your salary history. Don't try. There are in the job application market, there's a lot of effort to try to elicit from you either what your salary has been or what your salary requirements are. Resist it if you possibly can. And I've got a slide at the back of the presentation, which will be posted online, that explains to you how to resist this. And the reason you want to avoid discussion of salary until much later in the process is the more that your potential employer is hooked on you and convinced that you're the best person for the job, the better chance you have at getting a better salary. You also, if you can possibly identify the functional manager who is doing the hiring, a lot of times the ads either have you send things into an organization blindly or have you send them to HR. Try to find the person who's actually hiring and then contact that person as well. In the proactive job market, you want to use your network and find strategic connections that can help you and arrange informal meetings via your network. And this is the part that Wright Management was really pushing. And to be honest with you, I did not do as much of this as Wright Management was pushing for. I kind of used a combination of strategies between the informal proactive market and the formal market. But the idea of these informal meetings is that you're marketing yourself. When you contact people via connections you might have to people who know about the kinds of jobs you're interested in, and you let them know you're not requesting a job, you're really doing research, you're trying to find out more about the market in which you're interested. And you can use these informal meetings to build some rapport, make some positive impressions, and hopefully, if the person's impressed with you, there may actually be an opportunity via that person to find out about that hidden job market, and your name may be passed along to someone who can get you the kind of job you're looking for. But even if no position comes out of these kinds of meetings, you're getting valuable experience. You're learning how to go to the interview process. You're learning how to present yourself positively. You're collecting feedback. You're learning more about the job market you do want to get into. So, and this is a lot better than sitting at home and reading through job ads. So when you do get an interview, you want to prepare for the interview by establishing and practicing your selling points. Think of yourself as a package for a potential employer, as someone who has some attributes that can really benefit an organization, and learn how to sell that. Don't be shy. This is not the time to be shy. You want to research the employing organization. It's often helpful when you go into an interview to be able to demonstrate to the potential employer that you cared enough to find out about their organization. That often helps make a positive impression. There are typical interview questions you're likely going to be asked. Go out on the internet and find them, and then figure out what may be some difficult questions for you to answer and pull together answers and practice them. And prepare your own questions. Remember that this is not just about the employer liking you. This is about you having a good fit with the potential employer. So you should have some ideas about the things that are important to you in order to make the job a good fit. Dress appropriately. Be aware of your body language. Try to come in with a positive attitude. Enthusiasm, interest, and confidence are always good selling points. Avoid talking too much. This was one I had to watch out for. When I get nervous, I tend to get very talkative, and that can be a really bad thing. I mentioned before you want to go in and sell yourself. You don't want to boast, but you don't want to be apologetic. You want to strike a balance between those two things. And as I mentioned already, watch out for premature salary discussions. But above all, be yourself. Recognize that if you really want a good fit with the job, you have to be yourself. Your employer needs to like you as you are in order for it to work out long term. So after the interview, prepare some meeting notes. Immediately after the interview, sit down and write down a summary of what was discussed, what kinds of points came up, what went well, maybe what didn't go so well. Think about some points you may have missed, so that you can improve yourself for the next interview opportunity. And also send a thank you or email within 24 hours so that the person that you met with knows that you're interested, and that kind of interest and enthusiasm really makes a positive impression. You should have heard during the interview process, you should have checked on when the next step would be in the interview process. And if you've not heard anything by the date that was indicated in the interview process, give a call. Check on status. Just see how things are going. That continued interest also is important to employers. And importantly, continue your job search while you're waiting. And if you're not offered the position, send a gracious response, because you never know. You might have been their second choice, and it might fall through with the first choice, and you might find yourself getting that job after all. So it's always good to leave with a positive impression. After you've landed the job, you want to withdraw your applications from other jobs, update your resume and your internet presence. I have a slide at the end of the presentation about the importance of your internet presence, because a lot of employers do go out and search online and find out what they can about potential employees. So you want to get that all updated. You want new career goals for your new position, and you want to request feedback from your employer at appropriate intervals so that you can continue to grow and professionally develop. Most important, stay connected with your network and expand it, because that's what got you where you are today, and that's what's important in terms of continuing your job as you move along. So in summary, if you've got the right approach and the right attitude, you can turn losing your job into the best thing that ever happened to you. And this was something that I reminded myself when I lost my own job, that I knew plenty of people who had lost their jobs and ended up in a much better place than they had started out in. And you have to keep that in mind. And if you do, it will turn out that way. You need to have a safe outlet for dealing with those emotions. You need to work through them so you can get to the point where you are productively looking for a new job. You want that reason for leaving statement worked out, so you've got that short, truthful, positive story about your job loss. You want a thorough, candid self-assessment, as well as an assessment of your ideal job and career path, so that you can identify what's most important to you in terms of a new job. You want a resume that helps sell you as a potential employee, and a marketing plan where you can align your strengths and interests with the job market. This is another part of the right management approach that I wish I could have more time to talk about today. But essentially, you do an assessment of what's out there, you figure out what employers meet your criteria, and you go after those jobs most aggressively. You want to position for yourself for success in both the reactive and proactive job markets. You want to practice your interview and negotiating strategies and continually develop and refine your personal network. So, and the most important, once you've landed a new job, keep applying what you've learned, because what you've learned will help you get ahead in your job as well as your career. So that's it for now. I'll take questions later, and I'll pass the laptop along to Jill. Yeah. Oh, let's see. End show. And we'll get. This is.
Oh, bless you.
F5. There you go. Oops.
Excuse us just a minute while we transition. We have a Mac user and a Windows computer, which sometimes is an issue. Also, clumsiness is an issue. What am I doing? I hope so. I'm going to pull the whole thing apart. Okay. All right. Whoops.
And then, there we go.
Okay. Good morning. I usually don't do well with microphones. Can I be heard?
Okay. Good. Okay.
My charge in this morning's session is to describe downsizing from the perspective of a survivor. So it seems fitting to start by establishing my downsizing survivor credentials. My university went through downsizings, restructurings, and layoffs in 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2010. The university archives where I work was not directly affected in every one of those cycles, but from 2003 to 2007, our staff size was reduced 55%. So, excuse me. You've all seen these numbers, so I won't, or similar ones, so I won't belabor the bad news. Sufficient to say that in the last few years, millions of people have lost their jobs, and organizations in every sector are coping with downsizings. Layoffs certainly aren't new, but there are some differences between the 21st century workplace and the mid and late 20th century workplace. Decades ago, layoffs tended to be short-lived events that were made for immediate financial needs. Disruptions in production, declining sales, gaps between grants. Often, laid-off employees were recalled to the very same jobs. 21st century downsizings, by contrast, tend to be ongoing or recurring events. They're designed to meet strategic objectives that are midterm or long-term in scope, And because programs and services are reduced or eliminated, those same jobs are not coming back, at least not in the short term. Similarly, 20th century employment expectations were for long-term commitments to one or a very few employers. Jobs were characterized by high levels of predictability and stability, and the exchange between employer and employee was employee loyalty rewarded by financial security. 21st century employment is increasingly substituting mobility for longevity. Employees' commitments are more to a career that's going to span multiple employers, and rapid technological change and globalization are producing organizations in continuous transformation, which in return require adaptable employees who are themselves continuously retraining and developing new skills to remain competitive in the employment market. So we've all heard about managers or read the stories about managers facing the demoralizing task of telling productive, hardworking employees that their jobs are being eliminated in spite of the contributions they've made. And we've all seen the stories and heard about the financial and emotional trauma of hardworking contributors who have become unemployed. So on the face of it, the only people who aren't traumatized by downsizings are the people who keep their jobs, the survivors. And indeed, conventional wisdom is that survivors will be so grateful to still have jobs and will be so afraid that they might be cut in the next round of layoffs that they'll work harder and be even more committed to the success of their employer. The common expectation is that employees who are now doing two jobs due to reduced staff size won't resent or complain about the increased workload from an unwillingness to be seen as inadequate to the task, the tough get going. Similarly, the negative consequences of reduced staff sizes are often dismissed with the explanation that new technology and streamlined processes will allow remaining staff to do more with less by working smarter, not harder. And one of the most pernicious myths is that the downsizing was solely precipitated by outside forces or events entirely outside the organization's control. And when those circumstances change, everything will go back to normal. The reality is somewhat different. Social scientists and management consultants who study these trends have come up with a term for the unintended negative consequences for remaining employees after downsizings. They call it survivor syndrome. Survivor syndrome is characterized by a complex set of emotions, guilt at still having a job when your well-liked colleagues don't, grief at the loss of workplace relationships and confidence, anger at management, politicians, and any number of people get the blame for this, and fear, again, of being laid off in the next round. Untended, these emotions can turn toxic, resulting in anxiety, depression, fatigue that can, in the workplace, turn to cynicism and distrust, and ultimately, at the worst, disengagement. These are the employees whose bodies are present, but whose energy and creativity and commitment are missing. For the organization, the results of survivor syndrome can be reduced productivity, as employees struggle to keep up with increased workloads and uncertainty about what's now expected of them. Often, the very employees that the organization most needs to recover from the downsizing are the first ones to find other jobs and move on. And if, as a result of those two negative consequences, service suffers, users can become disgruntled, donors, both of collections and funds, can become disaffected, and partner institutions can become very dissatisfied. The more toxic symptoms of survivor syndrome are the result of mismanaged downsizings. Now, mismanagement, most of us know, is often like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. But this is one of those circumstances in which perception trumps reality. If downsizings aren't managed well, survivors may conclude that their laid-off colleagues were not treated with respect and dignity. If the reasons for downsizings aren't explained, survivors may believe it was a bad decision, that alternatives would have been better strategies. If the process of downsizing is secretive, survivors may feel that it was unfair or biased. And downsizing that is designed and described solely to ensure that the organization continues in business is unlikely to motivate the survivors. Survivors want to know, what is it about the post-downsized organization that will have made all of this pain of downsizing worthwhile? Survivors want to know what the new organization will be and what role they will play in it. Survivor syndrome can also be exacerbated when organizations don't accompany their downsizings with transformations. Smaller staff, fewer resources, greater competition, and a dramatically altered information environment all necessitate change after downsizings. But when organizations deny the need to change, delay implementing changes, or become defensive, survivors can become very frustrated and demotivated. So this is a pretty grim picture, but it isn't an inevitable one. Those of you who have gone through change management training are going to recognize a lot of these strategies. On a personal level, recovery starts by accepting that layoffs are an emotional experience. People have to find ways to work through the loss and the grief and the anger. And this process is not a one-size-fits-all process. The strategies that work are highly individualized. The pressures and temptations on survivors to work 12-hour days, 6 days a week, are pretty strong. But it doesn't help to give up your life. You need your friends, your family, your hobbies. More than ever, it's important to eat healthy, exercise, get plenty of sleep, and cultivate your sense of humor. Meditate, if that works for you. Pray. Read a story to your kids. Play with your dog. Do whatever helps you restore your sense of balance. At work, don't agonize over decisions that you don't control or influence. Focus on your own job, but by the same token, don't pull up the drawbridge and treat your coworkers like an invading army. It's important to stay connected, stay informed. Read the company newsletter, go to the open forums and the town hall meetings. It's also tempting to look for someone to blame, but it's a waste of your energy. Instead, you really need, and this is hard at the beginning, you really need to look for opportunities to be part of the new organization. Grumbling and glowering on the sidelines won't bring back the old order, it won't undo the layoffs, but it will prolong your misery and that of everybody around you. Some procedures in your workplace are going to have to change. Take the initiative. Here's your chance to try those alternatives that you've been thinking about or talking about for the last 6 months or 3 years. And if you can't be optimistic about or enthusiastic about new procedures that other people initiate, at least be willing to give them a try. One of the experts that I read advised, change the technique to save the mission. I think that's great advice. Seize every available training opportunity. This seems counterintuitive because you're already working so hard to keep up with increased workload that taking time away from your real job for retraining seems like it's not going to help. But you really need the new perspective, new approaches, different ways of thinking, both to contribute to your current employer as well as to develop your own employment options. And also allow the possibility that at least some elements of the new post-downsized organization can be better. From the organizational perspective, managers and supervisors are going to experience middle management squeeze like you never have before. because managers and supervisors are going through the same experiences that the people they supervise are going through, only with additional responsibilities. Over-communicate. Managers and supervisors need to explain the downsizing, explain the post-downsizing, listen, explain again, listen some more, explain again, and then repeat. The single all-staff meeting to formally announce the layoffs that everybody has already witnessed, followed by the cheerleader letter from the chairman in the next newsletter, is not a communication plan. Your choice is not whether to inform your employees or keep them in the dark. Your only choice is who's going to inform them. So absent credible and reliable information from management, the rumor mill will disseminate the worst case scenarios. Priorities will need to be adjusted. In the short term, people are not going to be operating at their highest level, and so realistic expectations are really key to re-energizing staff. Acknowledge the emotional issues people are facing and give them time to recover. New ways of working will need to be developed. And the irony, of course, is that the need in the short term to do more with less leaves less time and energy to develop new, streamlined, more efficient procedures. If you haven't already, now's the perfect time to involve all of your employees in planning these procedures. Management all by itself simply cannot make the new downsized organization healthy. Expanding participation also means increasing your tolerance for risk, because there are going to be mistakes. There are going to be failed experiments, but you just can't afford to agonize over it. You need to learn from it and move on. People are really confused after downsizings. Some of the people they relied on are gone, and it may not be immediately clear who has inherited those responsibilities. So it's also understandable that managers who truly don't have all the answers might become defensive. But dismissing questions and truth tellers about problems as resistance to change is counterproductive. On the other hand, making false promises and trying to shield people from the changes they'll experience is not a kindness. It only undermines their ability to cope with the new reality. At the same time, it's really important to tell people what isn't changing. In the middle of all the post-downsizing pressures, it's really easy to overlook accomplishments, but it's more than ever important to claim your successes and celebrate them and to reward people in ways that will help them feel, in ways that will help them feel connected and included. We have in the archives a phrase for managers who feel that they will only succeed by denigrating what came before them. These are the before me all was chaos and darkness managers. Even the most open-minded survivors have some investment in old procedures. Don't drive these people into resistance by ridiculing and denigrating the old ways they had of doing things. There are some, at the end of the presentation, some additional references. These are the real experts. They know a whole lot more than I do. So I would just leave you with the final thought that downsizings are undoubtedly, indubitably painful and disruptive, but they don't need to be disasters. You have to allow for the possibility that the post-downsized organization can thrive and that as a survivor, you can be part of that success.
Oh, okay. Hey, there we go. Good morning. This is a depressing conversation. But I'm encouraged because even after yesterday's trying day, the downpours that you all experienced in the morning and the stresses of the reception in the evening and probably another reception after that, and you all still look marvelous. So remember that as you leave. As the former state archivist of Virginia, I feel obligated to invite you all to come to Richmond. We're only about 90 miles south on Interstate 95. Take you about an hour and a half to get there. And I hope you'll come and you'll see the state capitol, which has been recently renovated. The capitol, of course, was designed by Thomas Jefferson and is an architectural landmark, certainly in Virginia and one of the oldest state capitals in the United States. It was renovated prior to the visit a couple of years ago by the Queen, who came to help Virginia celebrate its 400th anniversary. That was a wonderful event, too. I came to work each morning by Capitol Square, and at the time that the right prior to when the Queen was scheduled to be there, I came up the hill and I looked, and it looked like that they had erected some sort of blue screening or blue wall around Capitol Square, and I wondered what in the world was going on, and I think you can see here that actually when I went over there and looked at what it was were all the porta potties that they had brought in for the people that were going to come to see this Queen and participate in the ceremonies. Well, when I got closer, I discovered something else too. I know that the royals have had a hard time, but I didn't know that they were into the rental of porta potties as a revenue source. So, King's Rentals provided those for the event. So, but if you come to Richmond, one of the things I hope you'll do is come to the Library of Virginia, which is just right outside of Capitol Square on Broad Street. The Library of Virginia is one of about a dozen or so institutions where the state archives and the state records management program are part of the institutional mission. So we have a wonderful collection of material there at the library. There are over a million published volumes in the collection. There are, I think, about 110 million manuscript items in the collection. Have a large collection of prints and engravings and photographs and a rare book collection too. So I can't imagine working at a place where you don't have all those resources available. It's really been a very beneficial relationship, I think, for researchers as well as the staff. And there is a very willing and capable staff that's available to assist you when you come in. And they serve over 200,000 people who come and visit each year. There are some of them right there. So, as you can see, I think they were there for a Confederate reunion in the 1930s. I began my working career at the Library of Virginia in August of 1974. That was in the middle of what is now termed the oil crisis recession. It was marked by long lines at gas stations and prices that many people swore rose hour by hour. I can tell from the youthful faces in the audience that this recession is ancient history to most of you. So my response to that was to take the bus to work. I was working and thought that times were okay, but this recession lasted 16 months from 1973 into 1975. The fact that the archives at the library was using microfilm machines from the 1940s didn't sink into me. Everything was new, and so I was happy to be working. There were five subsequent periods of recession between 1975 and 2010. They varied in length from 6 months to 30 months, if you believe that the current economic troubles indicate that we linger in a recession today. Response by state government in Virginia has been strikingly similar in each of the economic downturns, progressing through what I now see are fairly predictable stages. The longer the period of downturn, the tighter the squeeze on agency budgets and personnel. Collections of tax revenues lag in state government. Private enterprise is aware of economic downturns months before the effect reaches state government and budgetary gears start to turn. A quarter or two or three of falling revenue collections gets the attention of those who monitor the budget for the governor and the legislature. In some instances, a recession could be almost over as the state starts to take action to slow agency spending. Recessions in 1980, 1990 and 2001 lasted 6 to 8 months. Yet the recession in 2001 had the most dramatic effect on the library budget up until the present. If you've worked long enough in state government to experience one of these economic downturns, you'll recognize some of the responses that occur. The first stage, of course, is recognition of that there is a situation here. The governor's office and the legislative budget analysts say they sense a downturn in revenues and will be watching for tax collections during the next quarter. When those collections come in lower in the next quarter, agencies are alerted to start looking at cutting back discretionary spending. This means that your agency better not be sending large numbers of staff to meetings or training, especially not to Las Vegas or Disney World. As the situation worsens, directions come to restrict travel, and there may be a hiring freeze that's imposed and instituted. If your agency has been sensitive to the economy and what may be ahead, your agency will already be restricting hiring and be creating a balance of unspent salary money for the future. The agency may also be asked to revert a certain small percentage of the budget, say 1 or 2%. The executive branch likes to call these cuts productivity savings. It is a cut in your budget, no matter what the smoke and mirrors games are being played by politicians. I think this type of cut helps perpetuate the public impression that there is fat in state agency budgets. The percentages are usually calculated on the total agency budget, not on its operating budget. Almost three-fourths of the Library of Virginia's budget is money that the library passes through directly to state aid to local public libraries. Of the remaining portion, the majority goes to salary and benefits for agency employees. For many years, the Library of Virginia has maintained all its programs on an operating budget of about $1.5 million to $2 million. Just as an example, a 2% productivity saving for a $30 million total budget would mean $600,000 out of an operating budget of $2 million, or about 30% of the operating budget. I suspect few of the institutions you all represent have operating budgets that include that kind of fat in them. With what follows as the economy worsens and tax revenues fall is a directive to submit budget reduction plans at certain target levels, 5%, 10%, 15%, for example. Usually agencies are informed that the percentage finally decided on may not be universally applied. Some agencies may get hit harder than others. Most recently, these targets have been coupled with plans for employee furloughs, unpaid days off, layoffs, limited service hours, or alternate work schedules. Some agencies generate funds that can be kept and rolled over from year to year. These funds may come from fees imposed for record center activities or sales of publications that the agency produces or from other sources. The Library of Virginia operates its local records program largely on fees collected for recording deeds in the localities. A number of other states have similar programs. Because of the pace of the real estate market in the past, the balance in some of these funds can be substantial. At the Library of Virginia, there was a point where the balance was $9 million in that fund. And a balance of that size becomes irresistible to budget planners. And despite evidence that we had expenditure plans for the next decade, this program has been tapped twice for $1 million or more. In one instance, the agency was not notified that the funds had been transferred. And such a maneuvering brings frustration to new levels, I think. So, as difficult and as frustrating as it is to deal with evolving budget issues, I believe the most worthwhile time is spent addressing the rising anxiety experienced by the staff. With staff and management, management most often are getting is information from the same source. And that source is newspapers and television. It's difficult for staff to accept that managers don't have extensive, detailed information about what is happening. My experience is that is just not the case. Senior management frequently does not have detailed information and shares the same anxieties as staff does. There's a further complication in all of this. When directions are eventually received from the governor's office about the plans to be developed and submitted by the agency to address the budget situation, those plans and the details are considered governor's working papers, part of the deliberative process, and cannot be shared with until decisions are announced by the chief executive. While the general nature of the agency's response can be shared with the agency's governing board and the staff, the details cannot be shared. Of course, that is exactly what the staff wants to know. So how do you work under these circumstances? There's some basic rules, I think, of organizational communication that apply here. Tell staff well in advance about possible implications of budget reductions. This helps staff with programmatic planning and to anticipate changes in existing service models. If you know that travel and training funds may not be available, delay that statewide conference or training program. Give enough information to explain why. This can be tricky. Too much information can be confusing. Seemingly simple solutions may be more complicated than they appear, or directions from the executive may limit what an agency can consider to do. During recent budget reviews in Virginia, the media was full of reports from other states of actions to close budget shortfalls by using shortened work weeks, rolling days off, and furloughs. It would seem that similar strategies would work for Virginia, except for the fact that the instructions agencies received specifically said that such methods were not to be considered because the state's budget analysts did not believe they would produce the savings they appeared to generate. Sharing the information with staff helped everyone understand the options that the agency had to deal with its own situation. As it turned out, the final budget plan for the state adopted by the General Assembly did include one furlough day for state agencies, but the number of furlough days was greatly reduced from some of the proposals submitted to the General Assembly. At some point, the senior manager knows the plan and that programmatic changes involve staff layoffs and who the individuals are who will leave. The senior manager can't share that information with subordinate managers under the governor's working papers provisions. So how can managers be given a sense of the impact on their programs? I recall my own meetings with three managers who reported to me. We engaged in a number of strategy meetings after I asked them that they look at their programs to evaluate the loss of specific numbers of staff. Who would those staff members be? How would their programs change? Could changes be made at the divisional or agency level that would lessen the impact on the archival and records management program? Their responses matched very closely the eventual outcome of the personnel changes. By asking questions, it was possible to take the section managers right up to the point of identifying positions that would be affected. Despite the number of conversations you have, and as pointed as your questions may be, you cannot be assured that the message that is going down the line to the staff. Though I thought I had shared as much information as I could, there were still staff that came and asked why I was singling out their program or their staff. It's part of human nature for people to view the work they do as the most critical part of a process or operation. It's the manager's job to acknowledge that the part each individual plays and to help the person understand how their role fits into a larger picture of the organization. Share information early, tell them why, and lastly, make certain that your actions match your words. Make sure that you walk the talk. The boss who tries to convince his people how important dedication to their job is and then is seen leaving the office at noon every Friday during the summer is not very persuasive or effective. It simply means that you absolutely must show that if it's important enough for them to do, it's important enough for you to support. The conditions that apply to them also apply to you. I retired in October of 2009 as part of the library's budget reductions. I was joined by two other senior managers with comparable service and comparable at comparable ages If the library's budget reduction target had been 5%, the departure of these three senior managers would have provided the funds to meet that target. We all enjoyed our jobs and working with our colleagues, and while nearing retirement age was on our minds, we were not ready to leave just yet. By this action, I think it was clear to staff that the decisions we had to make were made as equitably as possible and with the best interests of the agency in mind. There's an almost audible sigh of relief when budget reductions are implemented and layoffs are finally complete. There are other after effects, as some of my colleagues here have mentioned this morning. Working with a smaller budget is one thing. Working without individuals who you have grown to know and rely on is certainly on a different plane. I was surprised that there was a feeling within the agency similar to that of the loss of a family member or a close friend. It lasted for a number of weeks and had its effect on productivity. Social psychologists, economists, and clinical psychologists agree that worry, fear, and loss of self-image are common side effects of job cuts and losses. Those effects do linger. Continued communication with staff remains critical in the aftermath of budget cuts. There will be questions. Staff has a keen interest in the process of decision-making, I think. What are the factors that led to the decision to reduce one program over another or to eliminate one position over another? How were the decisions arrived at? This is the why question again. It's not easy to explain that there are some aspects of the process that relate directly to individual performance that cannot be shared. The most important message to convey is that these hard decisions are made with fairness and equity and with a view of the long-term interest of the organization. Careful attention is given to critical functions. Cost and staff resources are identified. Possibilities of change, adjustment, reallocation, and postponement are identified. And both immediate and long-term results are determined and evaluated. It is still a very subjective process, however. Staff can also be frustrated by seeing substantial cuts being made behind the scenes, while the public face of the agency and public service appears to be unchanged. After budget reductions at the library not too long ago, staff were saying that the public need to feel the effects of decisions made by the politicians to cut budgets. Cut after cut cannot be made without eventually reducing levels of service. Those of you who work with the federal government in D.C. recognize this tactic, the tactic that the Park Service uses. Their budget cuts always endanger the hours of operation of the Washington Monument. This news always produces an outcry, and somehow funds appear to keep the monument open. Interestingly, budget instructions for Virginia agencies came with a warning not to try this tactic. You know what the Virginia Department of Transportation plans included? They closed the interstate rest stops. This actually became a campaign issue for the next election. One of the current governor's first actions was to reopen the rest stops. I spent some time trying to identify a rest stop issue for the Library of Virginia. I did not find one. One step that the library took after the budget reductions in 2001 and 2002 was to prepare a statement for distribution to users and interested constituents on our reading in our reading rooms and through other sources. The document succinctly explained the impact of the reductions, and these included staff, collection development funds, hours of operation, eliminating two highly visible programs and one division, and a number of service changes. The document was available in the reading rooms and was included in every piece of outgoing mail for several months. It was beneficial for the staff to have the sheet handy in the reading rooms, and it also helped provide a consistent message of the impact on the agency that was not subject to exaggeration by one overly anxious employee. The private sector provides a useful example from about communicating with those who remain. An April 5th, 2010 article in the Wall Street Journal carried a headline, CEOs Welcome Recovery to Look After Staff. The article reported that the CEO at U.S. Airways Group makes regular weekly appearances at pilot training sessions. Quicken Loans CEO began holding weekly two-hour lunch meetings with employees, and PricewaterhouseCoopers chairman is asking executives to roam the halls more. The U.S. Airways CEO says he now spends about half his time with employees and on employee communication, compared to about 20% at the height of the recession. Quicken CEO reinforces the company open-door policy with pizza and sandwich lunch meetings with groups of 15 employees. All the CEOs reported positive employee response and identified employee suggestions that have resulted in positive action. I think it's well worth emulating the private sector example. Hard budgetary times can produce opportunities, most likely unforeseen during the process of budget retrenchment. Beginning in the 1950s, the Library of Virginia ran a full microfilming operation as part of its records management program. Service was provided to state agencies on a fee basis. By the late 1990s, the microfilm program was operating at a new state record center. It had spaces of its own after years of operating in the basement of the old library next to a non-functioning fumigator. While the workspace was new, the camera equipment was aging and expensive to replace. The processing equipment was breaking down regularly, and service was not available locally. Productivity was becoming a problem. Microfilming work being done for the library's own collections was falling far behind. There were efforts to redirect the program and its priorities. There was also a growing interest in microfilm applications for capturing electronic records. The staff were experimenting with the Kodak archive writer and digital cameras. It was clear that technology was changing and that to keep up with the latest products would be expensive. When the economy turned sour in 2001 and revenue started to fall, word came to state agencies to begin planning for budget reductions of from 5 to 15%. As hard as it was to look at severely cutting back on a long-running program that had produced revenue for the agency, the microfilming operation had a number of existing and growing problems. Rather than limp along for a few years with reduced staff and limited funding, for new technology, the decision was made to end the program entirely, except for storage of microfilm for state agencies. This was a severe blow to the program, and management recognized the importance of the loss and was determined to find some way to bring it back. One of the organizations or groups that we were working with was through the newspaper, Virginia Newspaper Project, was Preservation Resources, which was then part of OCLC. The library service provider, and we were using them as our service provider. Preservation Resources was acquired by Backstage Library Works in 2009. So inquiries were made at the time to OCLC about the possibility of a long-term contract to microfilm certain Virginia records. They were receptive and eventually agreed to open a studio in space provided at the Library of Virginia. The studio is currently staffed with two camera operators paid by the vendor, who also provides equipment, maintenance, and duplication of the camera negatives. Work that cannot be handled by the studio is sent to their facility in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The library guarantees a certain level of income each year, which has been protected even during the most recent budget cutbacks. There are many positive aspects to this arrangement. Supply and maintenance problems now are the vendors to resolve. Since the studio only does work for the library's collections, steady progress is made on preservation microfilming projects. It's better utilization of archival storage space and more convenient public access to fragile records. And we've also been able to expand this contract to digital work through the same group that has produced 4.2 million images through 18th and 19th century original court documents, and they're available on the library's website. There was no way in 2001 to know that one of the outcomes of the budget reductions would be to a unique public-private partnership that would contribute greatly to progress of our archival programs. While all our institutions care for thousands of unique treasures, I would propose that among the most valuable treasures are the colleagues we work with. Considerable time and expense are devoted to their hiring, professional training, and retention. To see such a valuable asset be lost during periods of economic contraction is especially difficult and disheartening. A constant understanding among senior managers that I have worked with is that it is far easier to secure money for specific programs or projects than it is to secure staff. The decisions we have made in tight budgetary times are predicated on this shared understanding. It is essential for an institution to have a strategy that outlasts tough economic times. It's just as essential to have a staff that understands and can carry out at that strategy. Management alone does not have all the answers to coping with downsizing, layoffs, or program redirection. The CEOs that I just mentioned found staff ready to suggest ways to achieve efficiency and economy in operations. If you want to turn pain to gain, staff is critical in getting there. If you remain in the archival profession for the next 10 or 20 years, you can be sure that there will be economic downturns of varying severity during your years of work. In my own experience, as I noted, is six such periods in my 35-year career. With the type of potential roller coaster environment that this produces, it's a testament to the dedication of those we work with that our institutions make the achievements that we do. Be respectful of your colleagues' commitment to their work. I wanted to end this on something of a personal and more perhaps a little more upbeat note. I had the opportunity several years ago at the invitation of the archivist, then the Archivist of the United States, to attend a Medal of Freedom presentation at the White House. This was quite exciting, and the people that were there were Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and Benjamin Hooks. A number of other people were present and received awards from President Bush. It was a wonderful reception after that, and I did the things that all tourists do when they go into the White House. That's Tim Slavin getting Benjamin Hooks' autograph there. But we took pictures of each other. We posed in various places. That's Tim Slavin, who was president of NAGARA, at the time. Kathleen Rowe from New York, and Carl Niederer from New Jersey, state archivist in New Jersey. Kathleen asked me to take a picture of her next to her favorite senator then. And so there's Kathleen in the White House posing with then-Senator Clinton. My personally exciting time in the White House was marked by a photograph of me and Carl Niederer in the men's room at the White House there. So Carl, you can see, is trying to swipe one of the hand towels from me in the men's room. So thank you very much.
Quite dangerous up here if you haven't inspected the stage. It doesn't go all the way back, so we're all constantly worried we're going to fall off. I'm curious. We should have asked this at the beginning, but we've had our panelists kind of describe people in a number of different categories, people who have been downsized, people who might categorize themselves as survivors, and people who might be on the management side of having to have had to affect a downsizing. Of those in the audience, have any of you, if you care to share, just by a show of hands, been downsized yourselves? Okay. Anybody a survivor? Anybody on the management side that's had to make these decisions? Well, so we've hit about all of you. We've got about 15 minutes left. Let me start with your questions first, if you have any that you'd like to throw to the panel, and then if the conversation lulls, we've got a couple of things we can throw out there. Any questions for our panelists? Yes, ma'am. So the question is for Elizabeth to talk a little bit more about what is meant by updating your internet presence.
Yeah, and I struggled a bit when I was preparing for this session
to figure out. I wanted to keep the presentation kind of on the short side, so I left a lot of details out. And, oh, great. And this is a slide I'm about to show you that I put at the end of the presentation. Come on. Essentially, though, your Internet presence, you'd be amazed at how much you exist on the Internet. If you ever want to do what they call an ego surf, go put your name in Google and see what comes up about you. This is a slide about Internet job search tools, remembering that SAA and ARMA both have career sites, that the archives and archivists and records management listservs can often be opportunities for finding new jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But you also want to think about a social network called LinkedIn.com in which you can post your public profile. And when I was on the job market, I heard an awful lot about LinkedIn. I was a little skeptical at the time, but it's got some capabilities quite different from Facebook in the sense that it allows you to find people who know people you know. And so in my case, when I responded to job ads, I would do a search on LinkedIn for that company, and I would find people that were either already in my network or were one or two people away from me, and I could use my network to access the people who worked for those companies. So the LinkedIn does two things. First of all, it gives you access to a network, and secondly, it posts publicly. It is the primary professional social network. So you can post a bit about yourself on LinkedIn and tell people about yourself. You can ask friends in your network to give you recommendations. So it's not just you talking about yourself. It's your friends saying things about you that help make you appear as you want to appear to a potential employer. So LinkedIn, if nothing else, is something to think about in terms of your Internet presence. But you also want to be aware of things like Facebook, because more and more employers are, in fact, looking out on the Internet to find what they can find out about you. And I think particularly for young people, I think of my grandchildren and some of the things they put up on the Internet, and they're young now, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily make them look very good to potential employers. So there's all sorts of opportunities to either be on the Internet. And, in fact, for some type of people, some people may want to go out and create blogs and actually create a presence on the Internet as an expert in some aspect of the profession. I haven't done that, but that is one possibility you can do as well. But any way you go, you got to be aware that the Internet's out there and it has a lot more about you than you may even realize. And you have to be aware of that, and you have to work to polish it.
Thanks. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. As an HR director, I can try and take that one. To be very honest with you, I think it depends a lot upon the sector to which you're applying. I can tell you right now in the government sector, I'll be brutally honest, I don't think anybody reads your cover letter. I mean, I really don't. I mean, other hiring managers here from the federal sector, in the federal space, I think what managers are looking at are the resume and then whatever supplemental assessment tool that's gotten you into the interview. And that's the honest truth in the federal sector. I don't know if on the corporate side, cover letters have a magical presence that maybe they don't on the federal sector or at the state level. But I think on the government side, I think it's a more routinized mechanical process of does this person possess the requisite level of technical skill that we need to order be able to qualify them for a job. Then beyond that, once you get in front of the hiring manager and they're looking through to interview, there could be a little bit more attention paid to some of the fine points in a resume or a cover letter, but then I think the emphasis very much shifts to the interview. I think it makes a good impression to send a cover letter with a resume, but just in terms of the actual, how much that's actually going to make the difference for you, again, in the federal space, I don't think that's a difference maker. I don't know if my colleagues on the corporate side would have a different view.
I think on the corporate side it is important, and I think how you present it depends a lot on the culture of the organization that you're applying to. So I think you've got to learn what you can about the organization before you make that call. Personally, bullets never bother me. Bullets are fine, a nice summary way of concisely addressing something.
Yeah.
I guess, and I'm thinking more in terms of records and information management here. Analyst might be a term you could look to as a possibility. I don't know. I've not considered that question before. Or project manager.
There's the federal occupational handbook too that describes. Archival position, and I think there's some related terms that are in that.
Well, yeah, on the federal side, it's pretty straightforward. You're going to look for a designation of an archivist, or there's an archive specialist, are the two most typical titles. Although we're seeing more and more hybrid positions created that don't easily fall into the traditional archivist category, and so there you may be looking for more general positions like records analyst or records management.
And I should have thought of information management. Mm-hmm. That would be a term I think you'd probably find in many companies.
I mean, I'm happy to respond to that from the standpoint of HR. I think you need to be honest. And again, I think it depends on the sector. In the federal sector, you really have very little negotiating room because of the way the federal salary structure is. There is, you know, always the potential to receive what they call a recruitment incentive or something like that if you're a truly exceptional candidate, or there are some other incentives in place. But I think in all dealings, in my experience, I think companies and organizations are looking to get the best talent they can for the best price they can get. I don't think that companies are looking to, you know, jip you out of money that you're worth. At the same time, I think companies also know when they're getting an overinflated estimate, and that sets off, I think, a bad tone from the beginning. So, I mean, the best advice is to be honest. Here's my current salary, factoring in benefits or other things that you might have. Here's what I need and expect in order to be on par with that, or, you know, to have a slight uptick if the job that you're taking involves more responsibility. So I think it's the best approach is to just be fair and honest, and I think most companies appreciate that. And if you're a good talent and they want you, they'll be willing to pay what's fair. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
For a young person who is looking for their first job as an archivist, I would recommend many of the same techniques we talked about here, the use of networking. I think the idea of doing interviews, networking to find people who know about the sector that you're interested in within the field, and just doing interviews with them and getting that opportunity to practice presenting yourself is a real good idea. In terms of the resume, In that case, where you might not have a lot of real practical experience, do look for any kind of experience that can demonstrate qualities that might be useful to you. So even if it was not a direct archives or records management kind of a job, but you had to do either some project management, or you had to do some kind of skill that can be translated into the field, be sure to list that. In addition to that, when I'm looking at entry-level candidates for a position, I like to see their education background, and if they've gone to a university that offers archival coursework, I like to know what courses they've taken. So that's something that I look for as well. Yeah, and I got to go back to my unused slides. Okay. So the leading paragraph, the summary. You can call this either a career summary or a profile or qualification summary. It's got to be concise, so it should be, the goal was three sentences, and that was the part that killed me. That I think mine came out to four or five. I just couldn't do it. So the first sentence should be a generic job title that describes your level of responsibility or your field of experience. The second sentence should emphasize and build on technical expertise, critical strengths, contributions, accomplishments, skills, talents, and/or knowledge. And the third sentence should be your management or leadership skills and work style combined with your personal characteristics and qualifications. It's a killer paragraph. It just took a lot of work for me to get that down. Very, very challenging. And that's the one, if you focus on nothing else in your resume, make sure you've got that. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes, so maybe time for one or two more questions. Yes, sir.
So you're asking about that my recommendation on the resume was to eliminate references available on request. Is that what you're asking? Yeah, that was a right management piece of advice. I think it's a given that if you're going to apply for a job, you will provide references. And personally, for me, it was really challenging to get my resume down to 2 pages, and any space I could save was very helpful. So there's more important things to include in your resume.
Last question. Can I go to the back just for give one more person an opportunity?
Good question. I had a very, very tough time with that, and in fact, my resume came out looking a bit more crowded than it should have. My margins were a little narrow, and it filled the page much more than perhaps it should have. And all I can say is just practice concise writing. Think about the most important elements and maybe develop several versions of your resume that can be targeted to the various places you might be applying.
Yeah, I mean, that's a general rule of thumb, and I know job seekers hate that, but it really does pay to spend a little bit of time customizing that resume, and I think focusing on the most relevant experience and sometimes the most recent experience. I mean, if it's really relevant and you did it 20 years ago, fine. If it's marginally relevant and you did it 20 years ago, don't bother, because I think most employers are looking at your past 10 years, your most recent history, with then maybe a short synopsis of, you know, what your career progression was leading up to, you know, whatever that level is that you're right now. Okay, maybe one more quick question. Going once. Did you have one more? Good advice. Thank you. Well, we are at time, so we are going to go ahead and wrap up. Thank you very much for being such an attentive audience. Hope you have a good rest of the day.
Thank you.